Hello and welcome to Bowel Cancer UK's podcast. We're the UK's leading bowel cancer charity. Now, we're determined to save lives and improve the quality of life of everyone affected by bowel cancer. We fund targeted research, provide expert information and support to patients and their families, educate the public and professionals about the disease, and campaign for early diagnosis and access to the best treatment and care. Hello, I'm George Alagaya. I'm a BBC newsreader most of the time, but some of the time I do some work for Bowel Cancer UK, and it's a great pleasure to be here. As you may know, I'm being treated for stage 4 bowel cancer, and today we're going to talk about living with advanced bowel cancer. As I say, something I know a little bit about. With me, we have Matthew Wiltshire. Hello.
Hi there.
Who was diagnosed with bowel cancer in 2015.
Yeah.
And we've also got Deborah Alsina, who is the boss. She's chief executive at Bowel Cancer UK. Hello, Deborah.
Hello.
It's great to have you both here, and thank you for doing this.
Lovely to
Matthew,
be
let me just start with you. I mean, it's a slightly obvious question, but what was it like? Can you remember being told you had bowel cancer and you need to go through all that?
Yes, I mean, it was... So I have two distinct memories. The first one, obviously, was when I was originally diagnosed back in April 2015. And as, you know, you're experiencing this, you're busy doing what you do. And then I just started noticing, you know, discoloration perhaps in my stools.
We're talking poo.
We are talking poo, yeah.
Okay,
we
good.
Do a lot of talking poo. I'm used to that now. So but it's not, it was never really blatantly obvious. You know, it was just slightly discoloured, a bit winey coloured. And as I said, I put that down to too much red wine and, you know, good living and what have you. But it just, and then you become paranoid.
I've got to tell you, Matthew does look like a guy who does a bit of good living.
I've had my share of that in time. But so you become a bit paranoid, obviously. But I just thought, no, it's not right. Down to the GP. And I was very quickly then sent for colonoscopy, endoscopy. And, you know, almost a week later, I was, can remember being very sedated and then being taken out of, wheeled out of the room, and the guy standing over me saying, you know, literally there and then, "I'm sorry to say you've got cancer." And I wasn't even compos mentis. I was still sedated. I had a nurse, I remember, rubbing my hand. They wheeled me back to the room and I didn't know what to do. Just left on my own.
Really?
I can remember ringing my wife, Sophie, and just saying, "You're just not going to believe it. I've got cancer."
Just check. It says you've got a wife, you've got kids?
Wife, two kids, yeah, two boys.
So how old were they in 2015?
2015 is 4 years ago, so they're 17 and 21. So they were then 17 and 13, yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, kind of teenage boys at the time. So, yeah, it was a complete shock. But I can remember even then him saying to me, you know, "Don't worry, I've got a friend at St. Peter's. He'll have that out in no time." And I was literally on the operating table 3 weeks from that colonoscopy, and they operated on me.
Can I clear just, so you phoned your wife, because this is I can remember making exactly that call.
Yeah.
Did you think about how you'd tell her, or did you just go straight and said, "Love, I've got cancer"?
I was probably still sedated, and
okay.
I was probably obviously an enormous amount of shock. So it was just the most bizarre, surreal thing to do. And again, that day going home, and I can remember actually doing the usual Google and literally feeling sick, you know, doing that Google search. You think,
see,
I don't
did
that,
Matthew,
that.
Because I decided I wasn't going to find out anything about this. Mm. I said to the oncologist, who I find, my diagnosis happened over sort of 4 days.
Right.
You know, and by the fourth day it was clear. It had gone to the liver, some lymph nodes were affected, and so on. And I remember saying to the guy, "Don't tell me survival rates or anything." I didn't want to know, but you decided.
So I went on it. I've never done it since.
Okay,
I learned. I felt sick and went to bed. You know, I just thought, I do not want to go openly on the internet anymore. Not a good thing to do.
Because, Deborah, I mean, the thing is, I mean, you know an awful lot about bowel cancer, but if you don't know and you do go on, you know, start Googling...
It's absolutely terrifying.
It's terrifying, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think part of the problem with Google is that there's a whole mixture of information out there not all of it helpful or accurate. And so we try and encourage people not to go onto Google. And that's why actually the information at diagnosis is so important from your clinical team. So you have access to appropriate evidence-based information that helps you come to terms with what you've just heard. But of course, there is a natural instinct. You know, I know when my husband was diagnosed with a blood cancer, the first thing we went on was Google and felt exactly the same, utterly sick.
And Matthew, so when you were diagnosed, I mean, I know now, I didn't know then, obviously, when I was diagnosed back in 2014, a year before you, were you told what stage you had?
Yes. So I, when I was when we went through that, obviously, we had the operation, they did the biopsy. I was very low-grade cancer, Duke stage B, okay? So it hadn't even gone through the wall.
So that's a bit technical even for me, even though, what does that mean,
stage
Deborah?
Stage two.
Okay. So it was quite low-grade.
So it hadn't spread?
No.
It was in your gut?
It was in the gut, not gone anywhere. So at the time, I was kind of, okay, this is all right. So they took it out. The surgeon was very happy, clear margins, no chemo, no other treatments at all. Go home.
I know you and I know what this means. Clear margins. I mean, Deborah, could you just tell us what it means when the surgeon said, you know, we want clear margins?
So basically what they're saying is they've got a good clear margin of healthy flesh from around the tumour as well. So they think that they've taken absolutely everything out, and that's considered a kind of a good surgical specimen.
I mean, in my case, mine was very low, but I remember him saying, I think I'm right in saying something like 8 centimetres either side or something of where the tumour was, just to get a nice bit of healthy
Yes, I think they flesh. I think they took about 10 inches of colon out. I'm not too sure. So again, I know. So then I was left with a stoma and ileostomy. But again, always knew that would be reversed because.
So this is just for people listening who might not know. Yeah. This is when. So they take in order to allow your gut to heal, where they've taken a bit out. They create an opening in your tummy where your poo comes out, and some people have to live with it. Long term, in your case, so what, it was 3 months?
I had about 3 months of that, and I was okay with it. I mean, it's not a pleasant thing to have to deal with. And yes, you can become, as you do, quite self-conscious about that. But
this is basically a bag hanging off your tummy.
It's a bag hanging off the tummy. And once the bag's on, it's sort of okay. And I could remember having waistbands to kind of make that, you know, very concealed, so you didn't really see it. It was more kind of at home without the bag, which wasn't quite so pleasant when you're cleaning and doing all those kind of things. So, but I dealt with it psychologically because I always knew it was going to be reversed.
So at this stage, you know, you've had the surgery, it's gone well. You haven't got the worst kind of cancer, stage of cancer to start with. But then it all, how should I put it, goes pear-shaped because
it was horribly wrong.
Yeah, what happened?
Well, so I was, you know, I'd even had the year all clear from the reversal. So it was in the October of the year, a year later, I just started to get an uncomfortable feeling down below. And I went back, you know, because I was having regular checkups. My surgeon at the time just assumed it was scar tissue forming and what have you. But, you know when something's not right. So I continued to push him. And, you know, after a while, late October, November, I was PET scan, MRI scan and CT scan. I can remember going back in again to, you know, for the dreaded result meeting.
That's awful.
It's terrible. And even his body language could show that it was.
Isn't that interesting, Matthew? Because I think they find it as hard to tell us as we are to hear it.
I think because he operated on me and had told me everything was wonderful, I do probably sense that there was an element of sadness almost that this thing's come back. So it turns out it's recurred in my pelvic region, in an awkward place because it's gone in between the sort of where the colon or the sacrum comes down between the sacrum and the colon. So it turns out it's in four sites now in the pelvic region. And this is, again, I don't read the statistics, but it's in the realms of very bad luck. For it to have recurred, it's quite low odds of that happening where it did. So I was then again faced with another journey.
How do you? Well, let me put it this way. I think I found it harder because mine came back. So I was diagnosed in 2014, April. I had operations on my gut, on my liver, various things. Then I had a period of I don't know if they ever said it was a remission, but anyway, they said, the scans were clear.
Yeah.
And then it came back, and I think I found it harder a second time round because I think I got, how should I put it? Got seduced into the idea that I was the guy who'd bolted and I'd made it. It was a great escape.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so to be told it came back was quite tough.
It's devastating. Yeah, I mean because we were still exactly the same psychologically, which for me personally is the real big issue through the whole thing. You know, physically I've managed to cope relatively well through most of it. It's the psychological challenges. So yeah, once you start to get on a series of bad luck conversations, you just feel like it's and that's the start of it, isn't it? You know, I've already had one. Now it's bad luck again, and now it's another. And I can remember with my mum, who I lost to breast cancer, those series of bad news conversations. So psychologically, suddenly I'm now thinking, okay, you know, I haven't got through this scot-free. And in hindsight, even now in hindsight, even then, I still think I didn't perhaps appreciate how serious it was.
I want to talk about the treatment itself and how you deal with that. But Deborah, there's an issue here, isn't it? I mean, for both of us, you know, the point at which you get diagnosed is incredibly important.
Absolutely, it is. Currently about out of the 42,000 people that are diagnosed with bowel cancer every year in the
42,000?
Yes, diagnosed every year with bowel cancer. About 10,000 people are diagnosed at stage four.
So that's someone like me?
Somebody like you. But then,
which means what? That it spreads?
So it does. So well, let's take a step back. So there are four stages of bowel cancer. So the bowel, which is made up of the large bowel, which is made up of the colon and the rectum, it's a bit like a hollow tube. So most bowel cancers start from these little like mushroom-like growths called polyps. That's right. And they're precancerous.
Right.
Now, that changes in nature. And originally, they start off contained within the bowel. And at stage one, you can probably whip some of those out even through a colonoscopy. That's you done. But some people, of course, will absolutely have to have an operation even at stage one bowel cancer. But most people with stage one survive, which is fantastic. And it's worth saying there's also a period where, because polyps and tumours bleed, there's also a period for many people between 7 and 10 years where you can prevent cancer developing at all if you can identify those precancerous growths. So that's an amazing opportunity for us to prevent it. Now, what happens in bowel cancer is that as the disease progresses, the tumours get larger, eventually it spreads through the bowel wall into the lymphatic system, and that becomes stage three. And as soon as it's
lymphatic system is stuff that's going around the body to circulate.
Exactly. And that means that the cancer can then spread. So in most cases, bowel cancer spreads to the liver and the lungs first, but it can spread anywhere. So it can be in the pelvis. It can go to other
parts of the body. So Matthew's sort of quite unusual, is he, that it's gone to the pelvis?
Well, he has, but I think it's also in your lungs too, isn't it?
We're still at the start or middle of the journey. So I was then treated. What happened then is I was preparing for pretty extensive radical surgery. So the next piece would be from a curative point of view, which is how they probably talk in those terms to you too, is surgery. So they were going to remove everything from my pelvic area. I mean, so prostate, rectum, bladder, all of it.
Actually, just before we finish with that, I just want to go back to you, Deborah. So you were talking about stage three and then when it spreads at stage four. Now,
It gets tougher.
It gets tough. That's the point, really, isn't it?
It does. But there is another bit of good news for people with stage four bowel cancer, is that it depends a bit where the disease has gone, if I'm honest. You can still be cured with stage four bowel cancer. And I actually remember, George, when I first met you, and you just finished your first load of treatment, introducing you to some long-term bowel cancer stage four survivors. So, you know, I'm really blessed to know lots of people who've been around 5, 10, 15 years post and living cured after stage four. But the reality is it does get harder. So if you start to have bowel cancer in multiple sites, or it's in a place that you can't, you know, operate or, you know, give targeted radiotherapy to, or there aren't drugs that can help knock it out of your system, you know, the odds become tougher.
I mean, I think the message, you know, far be it for me to be going on giving advice, but I would say listen to your body.
Yeah,
and, absolutely.
You know, and I wasn't very good at that. I had a great job, great family, you know, living at 100 miles an hour and loving life, and didn't listen to my body until actually, know, it was very late in the day and I noticed. So let me get back to you, to Matthew. So, you were talking about all this.
So I was mentally then preparing myself for surgery. And I got referred to a new surgeon now to look at that. Anyway, and he then re-scanned me and he noticed some spots in my lungs. And that was another moment of devastation. I can remember having that conversation because suddenly, even though I knew this surgery was going to be bad, I still at that point, I think I'd finally realised that anything's better than having lingering cancer.
Yeah.
Whatever they chop off and whatnot, I can sort of deal with that. So we then had to I then had to wait 8 weeks to decide whether that was cancer or just inflammation. Sitting around doing nothing other than waiting for cancer to grow is bizarre. So did that. It grew. It was cancer. I then went on systemic chemo. So I was then into the, you know, the big rage, the big infusions, the fortnightly drug
for
cycle.
People who may, because, you know, lots of people listening to this will be patients themselves living with cancer, but some people might not be. So when you say infusions, how does it actually
work? Well, this is the infamous drip, I guess I call it, where I sit. I had a port. I decided to have a port put in my body.
My friend. I still got it.
Yeah, and again, there's different ways of doing it. Some people I know didn't like that because it reminded them of having cancer. I just think it's just a straightforward and easy system. So I did that. So the nurses come, or you go to hospital, or I have it at home, but it's a different story, but they plug you in. But it's not just a kind of simple bag of, you know, stuff that goes in. So the bag's on there because it's pre-meds, it's Pyriton, it's antihistamine, it's steroids.
It's a cocktail of stuff,
everything.
Isn't it?
And you have a regime. I was on at the beginning, Folfiri plus something called cetuximab. Cetuximab is a more targeted style of drug. But boy, it gives you a rash face.
Teenage acne. I mean, this was nothing.
This is serious stuff. So you sit there for 7 hours, and what I would do, I'd have a nap for a little bit when I was doing the antihistamine because it makes you very tired. Then they pump the steroids in. You're quite lively, you know. So you've got this very changing kind of thing. But that's an infusion. So, and I was having that every 2 weeks.
So just to say, cetuximab. You mentioned this, which I think is a brand name. Is it?
Deborah?
Okay. So that's a new kind of newish. Well, why? Rather than me try and explain it. Why don't you try and explain, Deborah, that there is a difference between chemotherapy and some of the other therapies that are coming on board.
That's right. So as we learn more about cancer and the biology of cancer, new types of drug are being developed to target specific mutations. So you have to have a specific mutation within your tumour, or not have the mutation. In fact, you have to be something called RAS wild type, which means you're not mutated in the RAS gene. And for people like that, there are a couple of drugs, cetuximab, panitumumab, that can be very effective in terms of shrinking tumours so that, one, they can keep it at bay or keep it on hold, or, for example, if it's in your liver and you have metastases in your liver, that actually they can then be removed and there can be a resection of your liver and that's can be fantastic. Now, the side effects and then the toxicities to those drugs are pretty gruesome.
What amazes me is I remember thinking, you know, in maybe in 10, 20 years' time, we're going to say, you know, did we really do that to people? I mean, I'm right now, I'm on what's called maintenance treatment, and I'm temporarily off it, actually, because my skin just started peeling on my hands, and my oncologist said, well, I'll tell you what, let's stop it for a bit.
Yeah.
Just describe, if you can, Matthew, okay, so you've had the infusion, you've gone home. Just how you feel?
Well, it can be quite a mixed bag. So, weirdly, I'm most people, or I certainly, was buzzing because of the steroids. Mm. I would always know, day of chemo, don't even think about sleeping. I think the first time I had it was a general election, so I just sat up and watched it all night. So if anything's going to put you to sleep, that would be... I know, no, we'll avoid that. But I, you know, so I feel very buzzy, and then I kind of... crash perhaps
it's
after the
crash
when
after,
I come yeah. down off the steroids, and I don't like taking steroids again with the cetuximab. That then created a horrible rash, and because I was working at the time, it that affected me.
Okay,
that
so
then
you
affected
managed
my
to,
psychology.
You managed to work, did you? Through
yeah,
through
I did that this, all this through. I had radiotherapy to treat the pelvic region. So I had radiotherapy, which was unbelievably bad. I mean, that, from a side effect point of view, was my worst. I kept the faith, I kept strong and what have you, and I still managed some level of work, but I couldn't be...
What do you do, Matthew?
I work in the IT sector, in the tech sector, but I work in a sales-type role, I mean, with different fancy titles, but fundamentally I'm client-facing sales-type person. So when you have a face... that is going to scare most children.
Yeah.
You don't, yeah. Turning up for work yeah. sometimes in that environment's difficult. I've subsequently stopped working. I just couldn't manage.
Well, I've got to say, I take my hat off to you because the fatigue.
Yeah.
I mean, there were days I'd call the kind of sofa days when I just sat on the sofa. I can remember once because they tell you to drink lots of water.
Yeah.
And lying on the sofa thinking, right, I must have some water. And then 5 minutes later, I still hadn't moved my hand to get to the water. I mean, it's just everything slowed down.
Yeah. For me personally, I mean, longer term, the one thing I try and do is maintain as positive an attitude as I possibly can. I mean, my philosophy just simply was and still is negative energy is kind of a waste. It's wasted energy. You know, it doesn't help anybody. And the amount of reading and research I've looked into that says keep strong, scientifically it does. You know, your cells respond better when you're in a positive and, you know, without fear and what have you. So it is important for me to do
I sort
that.
Of think there are as many ways of dealing with cancer as there are people with cancer, actually, because we've all got our own
way of doing it.
Now... I want to talk a little bit about your. You mentioned your wife earlier.
Yeah,
it's a pity she isn't here, actually.
But
what's it been like for her, for your kids?
That's the thing. You know, I learned not to project forward. I live today as much as I can. My cycle maximum is 3 months because that's the cycles I'm on. I plan for a week and then I look at tomorrow, and that's kind of. The training that I've
Isn't
done.
Isn't it interesting? Because I have my little mantra. Mm. I get when I get into bed at night, I ask myself, "So George, are you going to be here tomorrow?"
Mm.
And the answer was yes, or it has been for about, I don't know, whatever it is, 5 years.
Yeah.
And that sort of sets me up for the next day. You know, I literally don't ask myself what's going to happen next week.
Absolutely. And I think that was something I learned. When I learned that it was incurable, that was I was picked up off the floor by some kind, well-trained people. And again, another subject, but get help, if you need it. And I did at the time. So that was critical.
Well, this is interesting. And I'd like to hear your view on this as well, Deborah. Do you think, maybe this is for men, slightly harder to sort of say... I'm vulnerable. Mm. I need help.
Yeah, I mean, again, my experience, certainly just even out on the social media thing, is there's many, many ladies, women talking all the time. And one of the things I tried to do was, and there are very few men doing it, but finding men my age, still of...
How old are you?
51.
51, okay.
Having to effectively earn a living and go to work and what have you. There are very few of them.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there are, but they just
can't
find them.
Deborah, do you think there is a difference? I mean, obviously there's a difference in how people deal with cancer, but a kind of man-woman thing going on.
Well, I think Matthew is right. As we both inhabit this social media sphere, there are absolutely more women than men that are talking about their experiences about cancer openly. And I think actually, for example, Matthew does a fantastic job of encouraging others, I think, to share their experience and so that everybody knows they're not alone. Also, we as a charity, we have a forum, which is an online community, which I think also is a kind of a safe space for people to talk about their experiences and share that. And I think certainly over the 10 or 11 years I've worked for Bowel Cancer UK, I think that sense of not being alone is really important to people. Yeah. But I think you're right, George. I think, you know, there is no right way to respond to cancer, and everyone does it differently. And you can't possibly expect everyone to be upbeat and positive every day, because it's just not like that.
And I'm not. Yeah. I try and remain as best I can.
But I think the most important thing is also to give yourself permission to know that you're going to have up and down days. Yeah. And remember that, you know, the treatment and the drugs, the chemical reactions in the drugs. I remember years ago meeting a man who just said, I hadn't expected it to make me cry. Well, just how awful that kind
My wife Fran always says, I mean, what she finds most difficult is at the end, sort of, you know, I was on a kind of, I think it was a 2-week cycle. You know, every 2 weeks I'd go in and I'd be looking quite good on the sort of day 13. And then day 14 I'd go and she actually found it very difficult to be with me in the chemo clinic and stopped, and my sisters and friends, you know, came and did it, because she said she could literally see me begin to go downhill as the stuff was going. Now, I interrupted you. So I just want to find out. You said you try and limit how far ahead you think. Yeah, I mean, what were you going to say about your wife?
The question was the family and my wife, Sophie, who, and I've got a fantastic support network. You know, I've got a brilliant set of friends, brilliant family who are with me and around me. It's the thing, the children is the worst. Yeah. That's the thing that I will go from being very positive to a heap and a wreck on the floor very quickly. What's sad for me is that I just wish I my children didn't have to go through this.
Yeah.
You know, as bad as it is for us, that I find difficult.
I think you're right, Matthew. I sometimes think it's easier for us as a patient than it is for those around us. Because in a way, what I've done, as I said, I've limited my life right down. I just look kind of 24 hours ahead. Can I do what I need to do tomorrow? Yes, I can.
Yeah.
Whereas for my wife, Francis, for our sons... Yeah. They are looking ahead. They're looking, you know, they've got their own lives to lead, but they're also sort of feeling like they've got to care for me and be sensitive to my needs. The
relationship subtly changes, doesn't it? I didn't ever want a 13-year-old to be worrying about his dad, you know, at this point in time. And Sophie, as well as the prime carer, they do an incredible job and get very little. You know,
so when you say prime carer, what is it?
Well,
the
person that lives with me, that is going to see me in all my, you know, good times and also bad times. You know, so as you, well, I don't know, when you lash out or need to or feel it, unfortunately, it's usually your other half.
Deborah just mentioned that there are bad times. I mean, there's you know, there's lots of joy, but there's plenty of tears as well.
But again, I try desperately not to show anger. You know, I could, you know, why me, all that kind of stuff. I try not to do any of that. So I try and be reasonable. But what I find is that, of course, in my moments where I want something to happen my way, perhaps, you know, who on earth can possibly argue with me because I've got cancer?
Yeah.
You know, don't dare tell me I can't go and do this or that. But so it's a very, you've got to, there's a balance. And we have our ups and downs, but we're okay. You know, it works.
You and I, Matthew, both are waiting for is some clever scientist to come up with something that's going to give us, the thing that we long for, which is a cure. So, Deborah, where are we? I know Bowel Cancer UK is now very involved in research and so on. So where are we with in that great struggle to find a cure for this thing?
Okay. Well, you know, it, in one sense, we're not waiting for a cure. We have one already. It's called early diagnosis. So that's why an awful lot of our work is focused on ensuring that everyone has access to an early diagnosis and also to best treatment and care. I mean, actually, if you look at the whole of the bowel cancer pathway, there is huge variation in treatment and care around the UK, and that does impact upon people's chances of survival
and
outcomes.
So what people commonly often talk about, the postcode lottery.
And it is really alive and well in the UK.
Okay.
And I think that's challenging. However, for people with advanced bowel cancer. So, you know, I've already mentioned that it depends a bit where it spreads to. So actually, if it's in your liver, the liver is an amazing organ. It can be chopped out and it will regrow and you can then just be cured.
I can attest to that.
Exactly. Yeah.
I lost 60% of mine. Apparently mine grew back bigger.
But they're now looking at different combinations of treatment, so surgery and radiotherapy, but also there is a kind of a whole new wave of treatments that are being developed called immunotherapy. So this is allowing the immune system to finally, cancer's very clever and it cloaks itself, but to unmask the cancer so the immune system can attack it. Now in bowel cancer, there are some new immunotherapy treatments for people with a very specific, very highly mutated tumour, so called MSI high. And actually, the immunotherapy drugs, there are two of them out there, not available on the NHS, not in the UK, unless it's on trial or you privately pay for it, but that are having amazing effects for those people.
But that's
it's very limited.
I was going to say, what, one in 10?
My cancer can't, I can't take it. Yeah. I've been tested for that.
And I'm told, I've been asking, obviously, everybody, you know, is there anything else I could be doing, Doc? And they said, no, actually.
But what we don't have, so, you know, my husband has a blood cancer. He's lived with it now for 15 and a half years. He's not cured, but there is an amazing drug that is that keeps him in remission. Yeah. So he's been in active treatment for 15 and a half years. Mm. We need that for bowel cancer. We don't have it yet. Mm. But the more that we discover about the biology of the cancer, the more that we will be able to develop these new targeted therapies for people. And, you know, in time, actually, we might stop talking about the site of the tumour. We might stop talking much more about the mutations that people have, which could be common to many cancers.
Can I just... it's a bit of a difficult question, but for both of us, really important one. I mean, already talking, how long before, you know, we see some of these things coming through, being available on the NHS? Are we talking, you know, 1 year, 2 years, 10 years?
So the immunotherapies are really complicated because they're very expensive.
Right. But
are they expensive or is it just drug companies making a lot of money?
Probably a combination of the two. Okay. I mean, I do think, you know, I do have a particular view. I do think we have to be sensible about the pricing of cancer drugs because it's just, you know, I get that a lot of money goes into research and development.
So on, sure.
However, there is a fine balance here between making sure that people are able to access the drugs that are developed and profits to shareholders and personnel want to see drugs get to patients.
I think it's a travesty when I see people going through what they're going and then can't get the drug they want. You know, there's a lot of people in that. I was lucky. I'm quite lucky enough. I've got private medical, so I get that stuff.
So for somebody like me who is just a huge advocate and fan of the NHS, my heart aches to know that actually, if you are unfortunate enough to be diagnosed with stage 4 bowel cancer, you are better off as a private patient.
Is that right?
It is absolutely right. And that cannot be right in our advanced nation.
We're going to have to stop here, but I'm not going to stop it on that thought, actually. I'm going to stop it by looking at this guy, Matthew, because you're an absolute picture of health now. I don't know how you do it, but you're looking
fine.
You're looking great.
You both do.
Give us a high five there. two guys living with cancer. Thank you, Matthew. Thank you, Deborah, for
thanks,
being
George.
Here. I do feel like we've, from what Deborah was saying, need to do more to get people diagnosed with stage 4 bowel cancer, but do it much earlier when it's something like stage 1 or stage 2. But also remember, we've got to remember that there are many people who are in remission that have been diagnosed late. And, well, you know, I'm lucky enough to be nearly, next month it'll be 5 years since I was diagnosed. So there's absolutely no reason to give up hope. Thank you so much, both of you, as I was saying, for coming. I've certainly found it very interesting. I hope you have listening to this. And don't forget, for more information about advanced bowel cancer or you can talk directly to people affected by the disease on the charity's online community. Deborah mentioned that earlier. Visit Bowel Cancer UK's website, bowelcanceruk.org.uk. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to carry on the conversation on social media. Tag us on @bowelcanceruk. Goodbye.